At the moment, Epiphyte has no assets other than information. It is an idea with some facts and data to back it up. This makes it eminently stealable, so encryption is definitely a good idea. The question is, how much paranoia is really appropriate? Avi sent him encrypted email. When you get to Manila, I would like you to generate a 4096-bit key pair and keep it on a floppy disk that you carry on your person at all times. Do not keep it on your hard disk. Anyone could break into your hotel room while you're out and steal that key. Now, Randy pulls down a menu and picks an item labeled New Key. A box pops up, giving him several key length options. 768 bits, 1024, 1536, 2048, 3072, or custom. Randy picks the latter option and then wearily types in 4096. Even a 768-bit key requires vast resources to break. Add one bit to make it 769 bits long, and the number of possible keys doubles. The problem becomes much more difficult. A 770-bit key is that much more difficult yet, and so on. By using 768-bit keys, Randy and Avi could keep their communications secret from nearly every entity in the world for at least the next several years. A 1024-bit key would be vastly, astronomically more difficult to break. Some people go so far as to use keys 2048 or even 3072 bits in length. These will stop the very best codebreakers on the face of the earth for astronomical periods of time, barring the invention of otherworldly technologies such as quantum computers. Most encryption software, even stuff written by extremely security-conscious cryptography experts, can't even handle keys larger than that. But Avi insists on using Ordo, generally considered the best encryption software in the world, because it can handle keys of unlimited length, as long as you don't mind waiting for it to crunch all the numbers. Randy begins typing. He is not bothering to look at the screen. He is staring out the window at the lights on the trucks and the jeepneys. He is only using one hand, just flailing away loosely at the keyboard. Inside Randy's computer is a precise clock. Whenever he strikes a key, Ordo uses that clock to record the current time, down to microseconds. He hits a key at 03 hours, 05 minutes, 56.935788 seconds, and he hits another one at 03 hours, 05 minutes, 57.290664 seconds, or about 0.354876 seconds later. Another 0.372307 seconds later, he hits another one. Ordo keeps track of all these intervals and discards the more significant digits, in this example, the 0.35 and the 0.37, because these parts will tend to be similar from one event to the next. Ordo wants randomness. It only wants the least significant digits, say the 76 and the 07 at the very ends of these numbers. It wants a whole lot of random numbers, and it wants them to be very, very random. It is taking somewhat random numbers and feeding them through hash functions that make them even more random. It is running statistical routines on the results to make sure that they contain no hidden patterns. It has breathtakingly high standards for randomness, and it will not stop asking Randy to whack on the keyboard until those standards are met. The longer the key you are trying to generate, the longer this takes. Randy is trying to generate one that is ridiculously long. He has pointed out to Avi in an encrypted email message that if every particle of the matter in the universe could be used to construct one single cosmic supercomputer, and this computer was put to work trying to break a 4096-bit encryption key, it would take longer than the lifespan of the universe. Using today's technology, Avi shot back, that is true. But what about quantum computers? And what if new mathematical techniques are developed that can simplify the factoring of large numbers? How long do you want these messages to remain secret? Randy asked in his last message before leaving San Francisco. 5 years? 10 years? 25 years? After he got to the hotel this afternoon, Randy decrypted and read Avi's answer. It is still hanging in front of his eyes, like the afterimage of a strobe. I want them to remain secret for as long as men are capable of evil. The computer finally beeps. Randy rests his tired hand. Ordo politely warns him that it may be busy for a while, and then goes to work. It is searching the cosmos of pure numbers, looking for two big primes that can be multiplied by each other to produce a number 4,096 bits long. If you want your secrets to remain secret past the end of your life expectancy, then in order to choose a key length, you have to be a futurist. You have to anticipate how much faster computers will get during this time. You must also be a student of politics, because if the entire world were to become a police state obsessed with recovering old secrets, then vast resources might be thrown at the problem of factoring large composite numbers. So the length of the key that you use is, in and of itself, a code of sorts. A knowledgeable government eavesdropper, noting Randy's and Avi's use of a 4,096-bit key, will conclude one of the following. Avi doesn't know what he's talking about. This can be ruled out with a bit of research into his past accomplishments. Or, Avi is clinically paranoid. This can also be ruled out with some research. Or, Avi is extremely optimistic about the future development of computer technology, or pessimistic about the political climate, or both. Or, Avi has a planning horizon that extends over a period of at least a century. Randy paces around his room while his computer soars through number space. The shipping containers on the backs of those trucks bear exactly the same logos as the ones that used to fill the streets of South Seattle when a ship was unloading. To Randy, this is oddly satisfying, as if by making this crazy lunge across the Pacific, he has brought some kind of antipodal symmetry to his life. He has gone from the place where things are consumed to where they are produced. From a land where onanism has been enshrined at the highest levels of the society to one where cars have no to contraception stickers in their windows, it feels bizarrely right. He has not felt this way since Avi and he founded their first doomed business venture 12 years ago. Randy grew up in a college town in eastern Washington state, graduated from the University of Washington in Seattle, and landed a clerk typist 2 job at the library there, specifically the interlibrary loan department, where his job was to process incoming loan requests mailed in from smaller libraries all over the region, and conversely, to mail out requests to other libraries. If 9-year-old Randy Waterhouse had been able to look into the future and see himself in this career, he would have been delighted beyond measure. The primary tool of the interlibrary loan department was the staple remover. Young Randy had seen one of these devices in the hands of his 4th-grade teacher and been enthralled by its cunning and deadly appearance, so like the jaws of some futuristic robot dragon. He had, in fact, gone out of his way to staple things incorrectly just so he could prevail on his teacher to unstaple them, giving him another glimpse of the blood-chilling mandibles in action. He had gone so far as to steal a staple remover from an untended desk at church, and then incorporate it into an Erector-set robot hunter-killer device with which he terrorized much of the neighborhood. Its pit viper yawn separated many a cheap plastic toy from its parts and accessories before the theft was discovered and Randy made an example of before God and man. Now, in the interlibrary loan office, Randy had not just one but several staple removers in his desk drawer, and was actually obligated to use them for an hour or two a day. Since the UW library was well endowed, its patrons didn't request books from other libraries unless they had been stolen from their own or were in some way peculiar. The ill office, as Randy and his co-workers affectionately called it, had its regulars, people who had a whole lot of peculiar books on their wish lists. These people tended to be either tedious or scary or both. Randy always ended up dealing with the both subgroup, because Randy was the only clerk typist in the office who was not a lifer. It seemed clear that Randy, with his astronomy degree and his extensive knowledge of computers, would one day move on, whereas his co-workers did not harbor further ambitions. His larger sphere of interests, his somewhat broader concept of normalcy, was useful when certain patrons came into the office. By the standards of many, Randy was himself a tedious, scary, obsessed character. He was not merely obsessed with science, but also with fantasy role-playing games. The only way he could tolerate working at such a stupid job for a couple of years was that his off-time was completely occupied with enacting fantasy scenarios of a depth and complexity that exercised all of the cranial circuitry that was so conspicuously going to waste in the ill office. He was part of a group that would meet every Friday night and play until sometime on Sunday. The other stalwarts in the group were a computer science music double major named Chester and a history grad student named Avi. When a new master's degree candidate named Andrew Loeb walked into the old office one day with a certain glint in his eye and produced a 3-inch stack of precisely typed request forms from his shitty old knapsack, he was recognized immediately as being of a particular type and shunted in the direction of Randy Waterhouse. It was an instant meeting of minds, though Randy did not fully realize this until the books that Loeb had requested began to arrive on the trolley from the mailroom. Andy Loeb's project was to figure out the energy budgets of the local Indian tribes. A human body has to expend a certain amount of energy just to keep breathing and to maintain its body temperature. This figure goes up when it gets cold or when the body in question is doing work. The only way to obtain that energy is by eating food. Some foods have a higher energy content than others. For example, trout is highly nutritious, but so low in fat and carbohydrates that you can starve to death eating it 3 times a day. Other foods might have lots of energy, but might require so much work to obtain and prepare that eating them would be a losing proposition. Andy Loeb was trying to figure out what foods had historically been eaten by certain Northwest Indian tribes, how much energy they expended to get these foods, and how much they obtained by eating them. He wanted to do this calculation for coastal Indians, like the Salish, who had easy access to seafood, and for inland ones, like the Cayuse, who didn't, as part of an extremely convoluted plan to prove some sort of point about the relative standards of living of these tribes and how this affected their cultural development. Coastal tribes made lots of fantastically detailed art, and inland ones occasionally scratched stick figures on rocks. To Andrew Loeb, it was an exercise in metahistorical scholarship. To Randy Waterhouse, it sounded like the beginnings of a pretty cool game. Strangle a muskrat, and you get 136 energy points. Lose the muskrat, and your core temp drops another degree. Andy was nothing if not methodical, and so he had simply looked up every book that had ever been written on such topics, and every book mentioned in those books' bibliographies, yea, even unto 4 or 5 generations, checked out all of them that were available locally, and ordered the rest from Ill. All of the latter passed across Randy's desk. Randy read some and skimmed all. He got to learn about how much blubber the Arctic explorers had to eat in order to keep from starving to death. He perused detailed specifications for Army sea rations. After a while, he actually began sneaking into the photocopy room and making copies of key data. In order to run a realistic fantasy role-playing game, you had to keep track of how much food the imaginary characters were getting and how much trouble was involved in getting it. Characters passing across the Gobi Desert in November of the year 5000 BC would have to spend more time worrying about food than, say, ones who were traveling across central Illinois in 1950. Randy was hardly the first game designer to notice this. There were a few incredibly stupid games in which you didn't have to think about food, but Randy and his friends disdained them. In all of the games that he participated in, or that he himself designed, you had to devote a realistic amount of effort to getting food for your character. But it was not easy to determine what was realistic. Like most designers, Randy got over the problem by slapping together a few rudimentary equations that he basically just pulled out of thin air. But in the books, articles, and dissertations that Andrew Loeb was borrowing through Ill, he found exactly the raw data that a mathematically inclined person would need to come up with a sophisticated rule system based on scientific fact. Simulating all of the physical processes going on in each character's body was out of the question, especially in a game where you might be dealing with armies of 100,000 men. Even a crude simulation tracking only a few variables and using simple equations would involve a nightmarish amount of paperwork, if you did it all by hand. But all of this was happening in the mid-1980s, when personal computers had become cheap and ubiquitous. A computer could automatically track a large database and tell you whether each character was well-fed or starving. There was no reason not to do it on a computer. Unless, like Randy Waterhouse, you had such a shitty job that you couldn't afford a computer. Of course, there's a way to dodge any problem. The university had lots of computers. If Randy could get an account on one of them, he could write his program there and run it for free. Unfortunately, accounts were only available to students or faculty members, and Randy was neither. Fortunately, he started dating a grad student named Charlene at just about this time. How the hell did a generally keg-shaped guy, a hard scientist, working a dead-end clerk-typist job, and spending all his spare time in the consummately nerdy pastime of fantasy role-playing games, end up in a relationship with a slender and not unattractive young liberal arts student who spent her spare time sea kayaking and going to foreign films? It must have been one of those opposites attract kind of deals, a complementary relationship. They met, naturally, in the ill office, where the highly intelligent but steady and soothing Randy helped the highly intelligent but scattered and flighty Charlene organize a messy heap of loan requests. He should have asked her out then and there, but he was shy. Second and third opportunities came along when the books she'd requested began to filter up from the mailroom, and finally he asked her out, and they went to see a film together. Both of them turned out to be not just willing, but eager and possibly even desperate. Before they knew it, Randy had given Charlene a key to his apartment, and Charlene had given Randy the password to her free university computer account, and everything was just delightful. The university computer system was better than no computer at all, but Randy was humiliated. Like every other high-powered academic computing network, this one was based on an industrial-strength operating system called Unix, which had a learning curve like the Matterhorn, and lacked the cuddly and stylish features of the personal computers then coming into vogue. Randy had used it quite a bit as an undergraduate and knew his way around. Even so, learning how to write good code on the thing required a lot of time. His life had changed when Charlene had come along, and now it changed more. He dropped out of the fantasy role-playing game circuit altogether, stopped going to meetings of the Society for Creative Anachronism, and began to spend all of his free time either with Charlene or in front of a computer terminal. All in all, this was probably a change for the better. With Charlene, he did things he wouldn't have done otherwise, like getting exercise or going to see live music. And at the computer, he was learning new skills, and he was creating something. It might be something completely useless, but at least he was creating. He spent a lot of time talking to Andrew Loeb, who actually went out and did the stuff he was writing programs for. He'd disappear for a few days and come back all wobbly and haggard, with fish scales caught in his whiskers or dried animal blood under his fingernails. He'd ram down a couple of Big Macs, sleep for 24 hours, then meet Randy in a bar. Charlene wasn't comfortable with having him in the house, and talk learnedly of the difficulties of day-to-day life, Aboriginal style. They argued about whether Aborigines would eat more disgusting parts of certain animals or throw them away. Andrew voted for yes. Randy disagreed. Just because they were primitive didn't mean they couldn't have taste. Andrew accused him of being a romantic. Finally, to settle it, they went up into the mountains together, armed with nothing but knives and Andrew's collection of exquisitely crafted vermin snares. By the third night, Randy found himself seriously thinking about eating some insects. QED, Andrew said. Anyway, Randy finished his software after a year and a half. It was a success. Chester and Abby liked it. Randy was moderately pleased at having built something so complicated that actually worked, but he had no illusions about its being good for anything. He was sort of embarrassed at having wasted so much time and mental energy on the project, but he knew that if he hadn't been writing code, he'd have spent the same amount of time playing games or going to Society for Creative Anachronism meetings in medieval drag, so it all zeroed out in the end. Spending the time in front of the computer was arguably better because it had honed his programming skills, which had been pretty sharp to begin with. On the other hand, he had done it all on the Unix system, which was for scientists and engineers. Not a savvy move in an age when all the money was in personal computers. Chester and Randy had nicknamed Avi Avid because he really, really liked fantasy games. Avi had always claimed that he played them as a way of understanding what it was really like to live in ancient times, and he was a maniac about historical authenticity. That was okay. They all had half-assed excuses, and Avi's historical acumen frequently came in handy. Not long after this, Avi graduated and disappeared, and popped up a few months later in Minneapolis, where he had gotten a job with a major publisher of fantasy role-playing games. He offered to buy Randy's game software for the astonishingly large sum of $1,000 plus a small cut of future profits. Randy accepted the offer in its general outlines, asked Avi to send him a contract, then went out and found Andrew boiling some fish guts in a birch bark kettle atop a Weber grill on the roof of the apartment building where he lived. He wanted to give Andrew the good news and to cut him in on the proceeds. What ensued was a really unpleasant conversation, standing up there in a pelting, spitting, wind-blown rain. To begin with, Andrew took this deal far more seriously than Randy did. Randy saw it as a windfall, a lark. Andrew, who was the son of a lawyer, treated it as if it were a major corporate merger and asked many tedious and niggling questions about the contract, which did not exist yet and which would probably cover a single piece of paper when it did. Randy didn't realize it at the time, but by asking so many questions for which Randy had no answers, Andrew was, in effect, arrogating to himself the role of business manager. He was implicitly forming a business partnership with Randy that did not, in fact, exist. Furthermore, Andrew didn't have the first notion of how much time and effort Randy had put into writing the code. Or, as Randy was to realize later, maybe he did. In any case, Andrew assumed from the get-go that he would share a 50-50 split with Randy, which was wildly out of proportion to the work he'd actually done on the project. Basically, Andrew acted as if all the work he'd ever done on the subject of Aboriginal dining habits was a part of this undertaking, and that it entitled him to an equal split. By the time Randy extricated himself from this conversation, his mind was reeling. He had gone in with one view of reality and been radically challenged by another one that was clearly preposterous. But after an hour of Andrew's browbeating, he was beginning to doubt himself. After two or three sleepless nights, he decided to call the whole thing off. A paltry few $100 wasn't worth all of this agony. But Andrew, who was by now represented by an associate of his father's Santa Barbara law firm, vehemently objected. He and Randy had, according to his lawyer, jointly created something that had economic value, and a failure on Randy's part to sell it at market value amounted to taking money out of Andrew's pocket. It had become an unbelievable Kafkaesque nightmare, and Randy could only withdraw to a corner table at his favorite pub, drink pints of stout, frequently in the company of Chester, and watch this fantastic psychodrama unfold. He had, he now realized, blundered into some serious domestic weirdness involving Andrew's family. It turned out that Andrew's parents were divorced and long ago had fought savagely over custody of him, their only child. Mom had turned into a hippie and joined a religious cult in Oregon and taken Andrew with her. It was rumored that this cult engaged in sexual abuse of children. Dad had hired private dicks to kidnap Andrew back and then showered him with material possessions to demonstrate his superior love. There had followed an interminable legal battle, in which Dad had hired some rather fringy psychotherapists to hypnotize Andrew and get him to dredge up repressed memories of unspeakable and improbable horrors. This was just the executive summary of a weird life that Randy had only learned about in bits and pieces as the years went on. Later, he was to decide that Andrew's life had been fractally weird. That is, you could take any small piece of it and examine it in detail, and it, in and of itself, would turn out to be just as complicated and weird as the whole thing in its entirety. Anyway, Randy had blundered into this life and become enveloped in the weirdness. One of the young eager beavers in Andrew's dad's law firm decided, as a preemptive move, to obtain copies of all of Randy's computer files, which were still stored on the UW computer system. Needless to say, he went about it in a heavy-handed way, and when the university's legal department began to receive his sullen letters, it responded by informing both Andrew's lawyer and Randy that anyone who used the university's computer system to create a commercial product had to split the proceeds with the university. So now Randy was getting ominous letters from not one, but two groups of deadly lawyers. Andrew then threatened to sue him for having made this blunder, which had halved the value of Andrew's share. In the end, just to cut his losses and get out of it clean, Randy had to hire a lawyer of his own. The final cost to him was a hair more than $5,000. The software was never sold to anyone, and indeed could not have been. It was so legally encumbered by that point that it would have been like trying to sell someone a rusty Volkswagen that had been dismantled and its parts hidden in attack dog kennels all over the world. It was the only time in his life when he had ever thought about suicide. He did not think about it very hard or very seriously, but he did think about it. When it was all over, Avi sent him a handwritten letter saying, "I enjoyed doing business with you, and look forward to continuing our relationship both as friends and, should opportunities arise, as creative partners." Indigo. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse and the rest of the band are up on the deck of the Nevada one morning, playing the national anthem and watching the Stars and Stripes ratchet up the mast, when they are startled to find themselves in the midst of 190 airplanes of unfamiliar design. Some of them are down low, traveling horizontally, and others are up high, plunging nearly straight down. The latter are going so fast that they appear to be falling apart. Little bits are dropping off of them. It is terrible to see, some training exercise gone miserably awry. But they pull out of their suicidal trajectories in plenty of time. The bits that have fallen off of them plunge smoothly and purposefully, not tumbling and fluttering as chunks of debris would. They are coming down all over the place. Perversely, they all seem to be headed for the berthed ships. It is incredibly dangerous. They might hit someone. Lawrence is outraged. There is a short-lived phenomenon taking place in one of the ships down the line. Lawrence turns to look at it. This is the first real explosion he's ever seen, and so it takes him a long time to recognize it as such. He can play the very hardest glockenspiel parts with his eyes closed, and the Star-Spangled Banner is much easier to ding than to sing. His scanning eyes fasten not on the source of the explosion, but on a couple of airplanes that are headed right toward them, skimming just above the water. Each drops a long, skinny egg, and then their tailplanes visibly move and they angle upwards and pass overhead. The rising sun shines directly through the glass of their canopies. Lawrence is able to look into the eyes of the pilot of one of the planes. He notes that it appears to be some sort of Asian gentleman. This is an incredibly realistic training exercise, even down to the point of using ethnically correct pilots and detonating fake explosives on the ships. Lawrence heartily approves. Things have just been too lax around this place. A tremendous shock comes up through the deck of the ship, making his feet and legs feel as if he had just jumped off a 10-foot precipice onto solid concrete. But he's just standing there, flat-footed. It makes no sense at all. The band has finished playing the national anthem and is looking about at the spectacle. Sirens and horns are speaking up all over the place, from the Nevada, from the Arizona in the next berth, from buildings on shore. Lawrence doesn't see any anti-aircraft fire going up, doesn't see any familiar planes in the air. The explosions just keep coming. Lawrence wanders over to the rail and stares across a few yards of open water towards the Arizona. Another one of those plunging airplanes drops a projectile that shoots straight down onto Arizona's deck, but then, strangely, vanishes. Lawrence blinks and sees that it has left a neat, bomb-shaped hole in the deck, just like a panicky Warner Brothers cartoon character passing at high speed through a planar structure such as a wall or ceiling. Fire jets from that hole for about a microsecond before the whole deck bulges up, disintegrating, and turns into a burgeoning globe of fire and blackness. Waterhouse is vaguely aware of a lot of stuff coming at him really fast. It is so big that he feels more like he is falling into it. He freezes up. It goes by him, over him, and through him. A terrible noise pierces his skull, a chord randomly struck, discordant, but not without some kind of deranged harmony. Musical qualities aside, it is so goddamn loud that it almost kills him. He claps his hands over his ears. Still, the noise is there, like red-hot knitting needles through the eardrums. Hell's bells! He spins away from it, but it follows him. He has this big, thick strap around his neck, sewn together at groin level where it supports a cup. Thrust into the cup is the central support of his glockenspiel, which stands in front of him like a lyre-shaped breastplate, huge fluffy tassels dangling gaily from the upper corners. Oddly, one of the tassels is burning. That isn't the only thing now wrong with the glockenspiel, but he can't quite make it out because his vision keeps getting obscured by something that must be wiped away every few moments. All he knows is that the glockenspiel has eaten a huge quantum of pure energy and been kicked up to some incredibly high state never before achieved by such an instrument. It is a burning, glowing, shrieking, ringing, radiating monster, a comet, an archangel, a tree of flaming magnesium, strapped to his body, standing on his groin. The energy is transmitted down its humming, buzzing central axis, through the cup and into his genitals, which would be tumescing in other circumstances. Lawrence spends some time wandering aimlessly around the deck. Eventually, he has to help open a hatch for some men, and then he realizes that his hands are still clapped over his ears, and have been for a long time, except for when he was wiping stuff out of his eyes. When he takes them off, the ringing has stopped, and he no longer hears airplanes. He was thinking that he wanted to go below decks, because the bad things are coming from the sky and he would like to get some big, heavy, permanent-seeming stuff between him and it, but a lot of sailors are taking the opposite view. He hears that they have been hit by one and maybe two of something that rhymes with torpedoes, and that they are trying to raise steam. Officers and non-coms, black and red with smoke and blood, keep deputizing him for different, extremely urgent tasks that he doesn't quite understand, not least because he keeps putting his hands over his ears. Probably half an hour goes by before he hits upon the idea of discarding his glockenspiel, which is, after all, just getting in the way. It was issued to him by the Navy with any number of stern warnings about the consequences of misusing it. Lawrence is conscientious about this kind of thing, dating back to when he was first given organ-playing privileges in West Point, Virginia. But at this point, for the first time in his life, as he stands there watching the Arizona burn and sink, he just says to himself, "Well, to heck with it." He takes that glockenspiel out of its socket and has one last look at it. It is the last time in his life he will ever touch a glockenspiel. There's no point in saving it now anyway, he realizes. Several of the bars have been bent. He flips it around and discovers that chunks of blackened, distorted metal have been impact-welded onto several of the bars. Really throwing caution to the winds now, he flings it overboard in the general direction of the Arizona, a military lyre of burnished steel that sings 1,000 men to their resting places on the bottom of the harbor. As it vanishes into a patch of burning oil, the second wave of attacking airplanes arrives. The Navy's anti-aircraft guns finally open up and begin to rain shells down into the surrounding community and blow up occupied buildings. He can see human-shaped flames running around in the streets, pursued by people with blankets. The rest of the day is spent by Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse and the rest of the Navy grappling with the fact that many two-dimensional structures on this and other ships, which were put into place to prevent various fluids from commingling, for example, fuel and air, have holes in them. And not only that, but a lot of shit is on fire too, and things are more than a little smoky. Certain objects that are supposed to A. remain horizontal and B. support heavy things have ceased to do either. Nevada's engineering section manages to raise steam in a couple of boilers, and the captain tries to get the ship out of the harbor. As soon as she gets underway, she comes under concerted attack, mostly by dive bombers who are eager to sink her in the channel and block the harbor altogether. Eventually, the captain runs her aground rather than see this happen. Unfortunately, what Nevada has in common with most other naval vessels is that she is not really engineered to work from a stationary position, and consequently she is hit 3 more times by dive bombers. So it is a pretty exciting morning overall. As a member of the band who does not even have his instrument anymore, Lawrence's duties are quite poorly defined, and he spends more time than he should watching the airplanes and the explosions. He has gone back to his earlier train of thought regarding societies and their efforts to outdo each other. It is very clear to him, as wave after wave of Nipponese dive bombers hurl themselves with calligraphic precision at the ship he is standing on, and as the cream of his society's navy burns and explodes and sinks, putting up virtually no resistance, that his society is going to have to rethink a thing or two. At some point, he burns his hand on something. It is his right hand, which is preferable. He is left-handed. Also, he becomes more clearly aware that a portion of Arizona has tried to take his scalp off. These are minor injuries by Pearl Harbor standards, and he does not stay long in the hospital. The doctor warns him that the skin on his hand might contract and limit his finger's range of motion. As soon as he can withstand the pain, Lawrence begins to play Bach's Art of Fugue in his lap, whenever he is not otherwise occupied. Most of those tunes start out simple. You can easily picture old Johann Sebastian sitting there on the bench on a cold morning in Leipzig, one or two Blockflöte stops yanked out, left hand in his lap, a fat choir boy or two over in the corner heaving away on the bellows, faint gasping noises coming from all the leaks in the works, and Johann's right hand wandering aimlessly across the forbidding simplicity of the great manual, stroking those cracked and yellowed elephant tusks, searching for some melody he hadn't already invented. That is good stuff for Lawrence right now, and so he makes his right hand go through the same motions as Johann's, even though it is a gauze-wrapped hand and he is using an upside-down dinner tray as a substitute for the keyboard, and he has to hum the music under his breath. When he really gets into it, his feet skid around and piston under the sheets, playing imaginary pedals, and his neighbors complain. He is out of the hospital in a few days, just in time for him and the rest of Nevada's band to begin their new wartime assignment. This was evidently something of a poser for the Navy's manpower experts. These musicians were, from a Killing Nips point of view, completely useless to begin with. As of 7 December, they no longer have even a functioning ship, and most of them have lost their clarinets. Still, it isn't all about loading shells and pulling triggers. No large organization can kill Nips in any kind of systematic way without doing a nearly unbelievable amount of typing and filing. It is logical to suppose that men who can play the clarinet will not botch that kind of work any worse than anyone else. And so Waterhouse and his bandmates receive orders assigning them to what would appear to be one of the typing and filing branches of the Navy. This is located in a building, not a ship. There are quite a few Navy people who sneer at the whole idea of working in a building, and Lawrence and some of the other recent recruits, eager to fit in, have gotten into the habit of copying the same attitude. But now that they have seen what happens to a ship when you detonate hundreds of pounds of high explosive on, in, and around it, Waterhouse and many others are reassessing their feelings about working in buildings. They report to their new post with high morale. Their new commanding officer is not so cheerful, and his feelings appear to be shared by everyone in the entire section. The musicians are greeted without being welcomed and saluted without being honored. The people who have been working in this building, far from being overawed by their status as guys who not only worked on an actual ship until recently, but furthermore have been very close to things that were exploding, burning, etc., and not as the result of routine lapses in judgment, but because bad men deliberately made it happen, do not seem to feel that Lawrence and his bandmates deserve to be entrusted with this new work, whatever the hell it is. Glumly, almost despairingly, the commanding officer and his subordinates get the musicians squared away. Even if they don't have enough desks to go around, each man can at least have a chair at a table or counter. Some ingenuity is displayed in finding places for all the new arrivals. It is clear that these people are trying their best at what they consider to be a hopeless task. Then there is some talk about secrecy. A great deal of talk about it. They run through drills intended to test their ability to throw things away properly. This goes on for a long time, and the longer it continues, without an explanation as to why, the more mysterious it becomes. The musicians, who were at first a little put out by their chilly reception, start to speculate amongst themselves as to what kind of an operation they have gotten themselves into now. Finally, one morning, the musicians are assembled in a classroom in front of the cleanest chalkboard Waterhouse has ever seen. The last few days have imbued him with just enough paranoia that he suspects it is that clean for a reason. Erasing chalkboards is not to be taken lightly during wartime. They are seated in little chairs with desks attached to them, desks designed for right-handers. Lawrence puts his notepad in his lap, then rests his bandaged right hand on the desk and begins to play a ditty from Art of Fugue, grimacing and even grunting with pain as his burned skin stretches and slides over his knuckles. Someone chucks him on the shoulder. He opens his eyes to see that he is the only person in the room sitting down. An officer is on the deck. He stands up and his weak leg nearly buckles. When he finally gets himself fully to his feet, he sees that the officer, if he even is an officer, is out of uniform. Way out of uniform. He's wearing a bathrobe and smoking a pipe. The bathrobe is extraordinarily worn, and not in the sense of, say, a hospital or a hotel bathrobe that gets laundered frequently. This thing hasn't been laundered in a long time, but boy, has it seen some use. The elbows are worn out, and the bottom of the right sleeve is ashy gray and slippery with graphite from being dragged back and forth tens of thousands of times across sheets of paper dense with number 2 pencil work. The terry cloth has a dandruffy appearance, but it has nothing to do with exfoliation of the scalp. These flakes are way too big and too geometric. Rectangles and circular dots of oak tag, punched out of cards and tape respectively. The pipe went out a long time ago, and the officer, or whatever he is not even pretending to worry about getting it relit. It is there just to give him something to bite down on, which he does as vigorously as a Civil War infantryman having a leg sawed off. Some other fellow, one who actually bothered to shave, shower, and put on a uniform, introduces Bathrobe Man as Commander Shane, spelled S-C-H-O-E-N. But Shane Schoen is having none of it. He turns his back on them, exposing the backside of his bathrobe, which around the buttocks is worn transparent as a negligee. Reading from a notebook, he writes out the following in block letters. 19, 17, 17, 19, 14, 20, 23, 18, 19, 8, 12, 16, 19, 8, 3, 21, 8, 25, 18, 14, 18, 6, 3, 18, 8, 15, 18, 22, 18, 11. Around the time that the fourth or fifth number is going up on the chalkboard, Waterhouse feels the hair standing up on the back of his neck. By the time the third group of 5 numbers is written out, he has not failed to notice that none of them is larger than 26, that being the number of letters in the alphabet. His heart is pounding more wildly than it did when Nipponese bombs were tracing parabolic trajectories toward the deck of the grounded Nevada. He pulls a pencil out of his pocket. Finding no paper handy, he writes down the numbers from 1 to 26 on the surface of his little writing desk. By the time the man in the bathrobe is done writing out the last group of numbers, Waterhouse is already well into his frequency count. He wraps it up as Bathrobe Man is saying something along the lines of, "This might look like a meaningless sequence of numbers to you, but to a Nip naval officer it might look like something entirely different." Then the man laughs nervously, shakes his head sadly, squares his jaw resolutely, and runs through a litany of other emotion-laden expressions, not a single one of which is appropriate here. Waterhouse's frequency count is simply a tally of how frequently each number appears on the blackboard. It looks like this. 3. Twice. 6. Once. 8, 4 times. 11, once. 12, once. 14, twice. 15, once. 16, once. 17, twice. 18, 6 times. 19, 4 times. 20, once. 21, once. 22, once. 23, once. 25, once. The most interesting thing about this is that 10 of the possible symbols, namely 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 10, 13, 24, and 26, are not even used. Only 16 different numbers appear in the message. Assuming each of those 16 represents one and only one letter of the alphabet, this message has, Lawrence reckons in his head, 111 quintillion, 136 quadrillion, 315 trillion, 345 billion, 735 million, 680,000 possible meanings. This is a funny number because it begins with four ones and ends with four zeros. Lawrence snickers, wipes his nose, and gets on with it. The most common number is 18. It probably represents the letter E. If he substitutes E into the message everywhere he sees an 18, then, well, to be honest, then he'll have to write out the whole message again, substituting E's for 18s, and it will take a long time, and it might be time wasted because he might have guessed wrong. On the other hand, if he just retains his mind to construe 18s as E's, an operation that he thinks of as being loosely analogous to changing the presets on a pipe organ's console, then what he sees in his mind's eye when he looks at the blackboard is 19, 17, 17, 19, 14, 20, 23, E, 19, 8, 12, 16, 19, 8, 3, 21, 8, 25, E, 14, E, 6, 3, E, 8, 15, E, 22, E, 11, which only has 10 quintillion, 103 quadrillion, 301 trillion, 395 billion, 66 million, 880,000 possible meanings. This is a funny number, too, because of all those ones and zeros, but it is an absolutely meaningless coincidence. The science of making secret codes is called cryptography, Commander Schern says, and the science of breaking them is cryptanalysis. Then he sighs, grapples visibly with some more widely divergent emotional states, and resignedly plods into the mandatory exercise of breaking these words down into their roots, which are either Latin or Greek. Lawrence isn't paying attention, doesn't care, only glimpses the stark word crypto written in hand-sized capitals. The opening sequence, 19, 17, 17, 19, is peculiar. 19, along with 8, is the second most common number in the list. 17 is only half as common. You can't have four vowels or four consonants in a row, unless the words are German. So either 17 is a vowel and 19 a consonant, or the other way round. Since 19 appears more frequently, four times in the message, it is more likely to be the vowel than 17, which only appears twice. A is the most common vowel after E, so if he assumes that 19 is A, he gets A, 17, 17, A, 14, 20, 23, E, A, 8, 12, 16, A, 8, 3, 21, 8, 25, E, 14, E, 6, 3, E, 8, 15, E, 22, E, 11. This narrows it down quite a bit, to a mere 841 quadrillion, 941 trillion, 782 billion, 922 million, 240,000 possible answers. He's already reduced the solution space by a couple of orders of magnitude. Schern has talked himself up into a disturbingly heavy sweat now and is almost bodily flinging himself into a historical overview of the science of cryptology, as the union of cryptography and cryptanalysis is called. There's some talk about an English fellow named of Wilkins and a book called Cryptonomicon that he wrote hundreds of years ago, but perhaps because he doesn't rate the intelligence of his audience too highly, he goes very easy on the historical background and jumps directly from Wilkins to Paul Revere's one if by land, two if by sea code. He even makes a mathematics in-joke about this being one of the earliest practical applications of binary notation. Lawrence dutifully brays and snorts, drawing an appalled look from the saxophonist seated in front of him. Earlier in his talk, Schern mentioned that this message was, in what's obviously a fictional scenario, ginned up to make this mathematical exercise more interesting to a bunch of musicians who are assumed not to give a shit about math, addressed to a NIP naval officer. Given that context, Lawrence cannot but guess that the first word of the message is attack. This would mean that 17 represented T, 14 C, and 20 K. When he fills these in, he gets ATTAC, K23EA8, 1216A83, 21825EC, E63E8, 15E22E11. And then the rest is so obvious he doesn't bother to write it out. He cannot restrain himself from jumping to his feet. He's so excited he forgets about the weak legs and topples over across a couple of his neighbor's desks, which makes a lot of noise. "Do you have a problem, sailor?" says one of the officers in the corner, one who actually bothered to wear a uniform.
"Sir, the message is, attack Pearl Harbor December 7th, sir!"
Lawrence shouts, and then sits down. His whole body is quivering with excitement. Adrenaline has taken over his body and mind. He could strangle 20 sumo wrestlers on the spot. Commander Schern is completely impassive, except that he blinks once, very slowly. He turns to one of his subordinates, who is standing against the wall with his hands clasped behind his back, and says,
"Get this one a copy of the Cryptonomicon, and a desk, as close to the coffee machine as possible. And why don't you promote the son of a bitch as long as you're at it?"
The part about the promotion turns out to be either military humor or further evidence of Commander Schern's mental instability. Other than that small bit of drollery, the story of Waterhouse past this point, for the next 10 months, is not much more complicated than the story of a bomb that has just been released from the belly of a plunging airplane. The barriers placed in his path, working his way through the Cryptonomicon, breaking the Nipponese Air Force meteorological code, breaking the Coral Naval Attaché machine cipher, breaking unnamed Nipponese Army Water Transport Code 3A, breaking the Greater East Asia Ministry Code, present about as much resistance as successive decks of a worm-eaten wooden frigate. Within a couple of months, he is actually writing new chapters of the Cryptonomicon. People speak of it as though it were a book, but it's not. It is basically a compilation of all of the papers and notes that have drifted up in a particular corner of Commander Schern's office over the roughly 2-year period that he's been situated at Station Hypo, as this place is called. Hypo is a military way of saying the letter H. Bright Boy Waterhouse infers that there must be at least 7 others, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, etc. It is everything that Commander Schern knows about breaking codes, which amounts to everything that the United States of America knows. At any moment, it could have been annihilated if a janitor had stepped into the room for a few minutes and tidied the place up. Understanding this, Commander Schern's colleagues in the officers' ranks of Station Hypo have devised strenuous measures to prevent any type of tidying or hygienic operations of any description in the entire wing of the building that contains Commander Schern's office. They know enough, in other words, to understand that the Cryptonomicon is terribly important, and they have the wit to take the measures necessary to keep it safe. Some of them actually consult it from time to time and use its wisdom to break Nipponese messages or even solve whole cryptosystems. But Waterhouse is the first guy to come along who is good enough to, at first, point out errors in what Schern has written, and soon assemble the contents of the pile into something like an orderly work, and eventually add original material onto it. At some point, Schern takes him downstairs and leads him to the end of a long, windowless corridor to a slab of a door guarded by hulking myrmidons, and lets him see the second coolest thing they've got at Pearl Harbor, a room full of machinery from the Electrical Till Corporation that they use mainly for doing frequency counts on NIP intercepts. The most remarkable machine at Station Hypo, however, assuming provisionally that Alan is wrong and that human brains are not machines, and the first coolest thing in Pearl Harbor, is even deeper in the cloaca of the building. It is contained in something that might be likened to a bank vault if it weren't all wired up with explosives so that its contents can be vaporized in the event of a total NIP invasion. This is the machine that Commander Shern made more than a year ago for breaking the Nipponese cipher called Indigo. Apparently, as of the beginning of 1940, Shern was a well-adjusted and mentally healthy young man, into whose lap was dumped some great big long lists of numbers compiled from intercept stations around the Pacific. Perhaps, Waterhouse thinks, Alpha, Bravo, etc. These numbers were Nipponese messages that had been encrypted somehow. Circumstantial evidence suggested that it had been done by some kind of machine, but absolutely nothing was known about the machine, whether it used gears or rotary switches or plug boards, or some combination thereof, or some other kind of mechanism that hadn't even been thought of by white people yet. How many such mechanisms it did or didn't use, specific details of how it used them. All that could be said was that these numbers, which seemed completely random, had been transmitted, perhaps even incorrectly. Other than that, Shern had nothing, nothing to work on. As of the middle of 1941, then, this machine existed in this vault here at Station Hypo. It existed because Shern had built it. The machine perfectly decrypted every Indigo message that the intercept stations picked up, and was therefore necessarily an exact functional duplication of the Nipponese Indigo code machine, though neither Shern nor any other American had ever laid eyes on one. Shern had built the thing simply by looking at those great big long lists of essentially random numbers and using some process of induction to figure it out. Somewhere along the line, he had become totally debilitated psychologically and begun to suffer nervous breakdowns at the rate of about one every week or two. As of the actual outbreak of war with Nippon, Shern is on disability and taking lots of drugs. Waterhouse spends as much time with Shern as he is allowed to, because he's pretty sure that whatever happened inside of Shern's head, between when the lists of apparently random numbers were dumped into his lap and when he finished building his machine, is an example of a non-computable process. Waterhouse's security clearance is upgraded about once a month until it reaches the highest conceivable level, or so he thinks, which is ultra magic. Ultra is what the Brits call the intelligence they get from having broken the German Enigma machine. Magic is what the Yanks call the intelligence they get from Indigo. In any case, Lawrence now gets to see the ultra magic summaries, which are bound documents with dramatic alternating red and black paragraphs printed on the front cover. Paragraph number 3 states, "No action is to be taken on information herein reported, regardless of temporary advantage, if such action might have the effect of revealing the existence of the source to the enemy." Seems clear enough, right? But Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is not so damn sure. "If such action might have the effect of revealing..." At about the same time, Waterhouse has made a realization about himself. He has found that he works best when he is not horny, which is to say, in the day or so following ejaculation. So, as a part of his duty to the United States, he has begun to spend a lot of time in whorehouses. But he can't have that much actual sex on what is still a glockenspiel player's pay, and so he limits himself to what are euphemistically called massages. Action. Effect. Revealing. The words stay with him like the clap. He lies on his back during these massages, arms crossed over his eyes, mumbling the words to himself. Something bothers him. He has learned that when something bothers him in this particular way, it usually leads to his writing a new paper. But first he has to do a lot of hard mental pick-and-shovel work. It all comes to him explosively during the Battle of Midway, while he and his comrades are spending 24 hours a day down among those ETC machines, decrypting Yamamoto's messages, telling Nimitz exactly where to find the Nip fleet. What are the chances of Nimitz finding that fleet by accident? That's what Yamamoto must be asking himself. It is all a question, oddly enough, of information theory. Action. What is an action? It might be anything. It might be something obvious, like bombing a Nipponese military installation. Everyone would agree that this would constitute an action. But it might also be something like changing the course of an aircraft carrier by 5 degrees, or not doing so. Or having exactly the right package of forces off Midway to hammer the Nipponese invasion fleet. it could mean something much less dramatic, like canceling plans for an action. An action, in a certain sense, might even be the total absence of activity. Any of these might be rational responses on the part of some commander to information herein reported, but any of them might be observable by the Nipponese, and hence any of them would impart information to the Nipponese. How good might those Nips be at abstracting information from a noisy channel? Do they have any Sherns? Effect. So what if the Nips did observe it? What would the effect be exactly? And under what circumstances might the effect be revealing the existence of the source to the enemy? If the action is one that could never have happened unless the Americans were breaking Indigo, then it will constitute proof to the Nipponese that the Americans have broken it. The existence of the source, the machine that Commander Sherrn built, will be revealed. Waterhouse trusts that no Americans will be that stupid. But what if it isn't that clear-cut? What if the action is one that would merely be really improbable unless the Americans were breaking the code? What if the Americans, in the long run, are just too damn lucky? And how closely can you play that game? A pair of loaded dice that comes up sevens every time is detected in a few throws. A pair that comes up sevens only 1% more frequently than a straight pair is harder to detect. You have to throw the dice many more times in order for your opponent to prove anything. If the Nips keep getting ambushed, if they keep finding their own ambushes spoiled, if their merchant ships happen to cross paths with American subs more often than pure probability would suggest, how long until they figure it out? Waterhouse writes papers on the subject, keeps pestering people with them. Then one day, Waterhouse receives a new set of orders. The orders arrive encrypted into groups of 5 random-looking letters, printed out on the blue tissue paper that is used for top-secret cablegrams. The message has been encrypted in Washington using a one-time pad, which is a slow and awkward but, in theory, perfectly unbreakable cipher, used for the most important messages. Waterhouse knows this because he is one of the only 2 persons in Pearl Harbor who has the clearance to decrypt it. The other one is Commander Sherrn, and he is under sedation today. The duty officer opens up the appropriate safe and gives him the one-time pad for the day, which is basically a piece of graph paper covered with numbers printed in groups of 5. The numbers have been chosen by secretaries in a basement in Washington by shuffling cards or drawing chits out of a hat. They are pure noise. One copy of the pure noise is in Waterhouse's hands, and the other copy is used by the person who encrypted this message in Washington. Waterhouse sits down and gets to work, subtracting noise from ciphertext to produce plain text. The first thing he sees is that this message's classification is not merely top secret or even ultra, but something entirely new, ultra mega. The message states that after thoroughly destroying this message, he, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, is to proceed to London, England by the fastest available means. All ships, trains, and airplanes, even submarines, will be made available to him. Though a member of the U.S. Navy, he is even to be provided with an extra uniform, an army uniform, in case it simplifies matters for him. The one thing he must never, ever do is place himself in a situation where he could be captured by the enemy. In this sense, the war is suddenly over for Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse.
The Spawn of Onan. A network of channel-sized air ducts as vast and unfathomable as the global internet ramifies through the thick walls and ceilings of the hotel and makes dim, attenuated noises that suggest that hidden deep within that system are jet engine proving grounds, Iron Age smithies, wretched prisoners draped with clanging chains, and writhing clumps of snakes. Randy knows that the system is not a closed loop, that it is somewhere connected to the Earth's atmosphere, because faint street smells drift in from outside. For all he knows, they may take an hour to work their way into his room. After he has been living there for a couple of weeks, the smells come to function as an olfactory alarm clock. He sleeps to the smell of diesel exhaust because the traffic conditions of Manila require that the container ships load and unload only at night. Manila sprawls along a warm and placid bay that is an infinite reservoir of mugginess, and because the atmosphere is as thick and opaque and hot as a glass of milk straight from the cow's udder, it begins to glow when the sun rises. At this, Manila's regiments and divisions of fighting cocks, imprisoned in makeshift hutches on every rooftop, balcony, and yard, begin to crow. The people come awake and begin to burn coal. Coal smoke is the smell that wakes Randy up. Randy Waterhouse is in merely decent physical condition. His doctor ritualistically tells him that he could lose 20 pounds, but it's not obvious where that 20 pounds would actually come from. He has no beer gut, no flagrant love handles. The offending pounds seem to be spread evenly over his keg-like torso. Or so he tells himself every morning, standing in front of the billboard-sized mirror of his suite. Randy and Charlene's house in California contains practically no mirrors, and he had lost track of what he looks like. Now he sees that he has become atavistically hairy, and his beard glints, because it is shot through with gray hairs. Every day he dares himself to shave that beard off. In the tropics, you want to have as much skin as possible exposed to the air, with sweat sheeting down it. One evening, when Avi and his family had been over for dinner, Randy had said, "I'm the beard, Avi's the suit," as a way of explaining their business relationship. And from that point, Charlene had been off and running. Charlene has recently finished a scholarly article deconstructing beards. In particular, she was aiming at beard culture in the Northern California high-tech community, Randy's crowd. Her paper began by demolishing, somehow, the assumption that beards were more natural or easier to maintain than clean-shavenness. She actually published statistics from Gillette's research department comparing the amount of time that bearded and beardless men spent in the bathroom each day, proving that the difference was not statistically significant. Randy had any number of objections to the way in which these statistics were gathered, but Charlene was having none of it. "It is counterintuitive," she said. She was in a big hurry to move on to the meat of her argument. She went up to San Francisco and bought a few $100 worth of pornography at a boîte that catered to shaving fetishists. For a couple of weeks, Randy couldn't come home in the evening without finding Charlene stacked out in front of the TV with a bowl of popcorn and a dictaphone, watching a video of a straight razor being drawn along wet, soapy flesh. She taped a few lengthy interviews with some actual shaving fetishists, who described in great detail the feeling of nakedness and vulnerability shaving gave them, and how erotic that was, especially when freshly shaved areas were slapped or spanked. She worked up a detailed comparison of the iconography of shaving fetishist porn and that of shaving product commercials shown on national TV during football games, and proved that they were basically indistinguishable. You could actually buy videotapes of bootleg shaving cream and razor ads in the same places that sold the out-and-out pornography. She pulled down statistics on racial variation in beard growth. American Indians didn't grow beards. Asians hardly did. Africans were a special case because daily shaving gave them a painful skin condition. "The ability to grow heavy, full beards as a matter of choice appears to be a privilege accorded by nature solely to white males," she wrote. Alarm bells, red lights, and screaming klaxons went off in Randy's mind when he happened across that phrase. "But this assertion buys into a specious subsumption. Nature is a socially constructed discourse, not an objective reality." Many footnotes here. "That is doubly true in the case of the nature that accords full beards to the specific minority population of Northern European males. Homo sapiens evolved in climactic zones where facial hair was of little practical use. The development of an offshoot of the species characterized by densely bearded males is an adaptive response to cold climates. These climates did not naturally invade the habitats of early humans. Rather, the humans invaded geographical regions where such climates prevailed. This geographical transgression was strictly a sociocultural event, and so all physical adaptations to it must be placed in the same category, including the development of dense facial hair." Charlene published the results of a survey she had organized in which a few hundred women were asked for their opinions. Essentially, all of them said that they preferred clean-shaven men to those who were either stubbly or bearded. In short order, Charlene proved that having a beard was just one element of a syndrome strongly correlated to racist and sexist attitudes, and to the pattern of emotional unavailability so often bemoaned by the female partners of white males, especially ones who were technologically oriented. The boundary between self and environment is a social construct. In Western cultures, this boundary is supposed to be sharp and distinct. The beard is an outward symbol of that boundary, a distancing technique. To shave off the beard, or any body hair, is to symbolically annihilate the essentially specious boundary separating self from other. And so on. The paper was rapturously received by peer reviewers and immediately accepted for publication in a major international journal. Charlene is presenting some related work at the War as Text Conference, Unshavenness as Signifier in World War II Movies. On the strength of her beard work, three different Ivy League schools are fighting over who will get to hire her. Randy does not want to move to the East Coast. Worse yet, he has a full beard, which makes him feel dreadfully incorrect whenever he ventures out with her. He proposed to Charlene that perhaps he should issue a press release stating that he shaves the rest of his body every day. She did not think it was very funny. He realized, when he was halfway over the Pacific Ocean, that all of her work was basically an elaborate prophecy of the doom of their relationship. Now he is thinking of shaving his beard off. He might do his scalp and his upper body while he's at it. He is in the habit of doing a lot of vigorous walking. By the standards of the body Nazis who infest California and Seattle, this is only a marginal improvement over, say, sitting in front of a television, chain-smoking unfiltered cigarettes, and eating suet from a tub. But he has stuck to his walking doggedly while his friends have taken up fitness fads and dropped them. It has become a point of pride with him, and he's not about to stop just because he is living in Manila. Damn, it's hot. Hairlessness would be a good thing here. Only two good things came out of Randy's ill-fated first business foray with the food-gathering software. First, it scared him away from trying to do any kind of business, at least until he had the foggiest idea of what he was getting into. Second, he developed a lasting friendship with Avi, his old gaming buddy, now in Minneapolis, who displayed integrity and a good sense of humor. At the suggestion of his lawyer, who by that point was one of his major creditors, Randy declared personal bankruptcy, and then moved to Central California with Charlene. She had gotten her Ph.D. and landed a teaching assistant job at one of the three siblings. Randy enrolled at another sibling with the aim of getting his master's degree in astronomy. This made him a grad student, and grad students existed not to learn things but to relieve the tenured faculty members of tiresome burdens, such as educating people and doing research. Within a month of his arrival, Randy solved some trivial computer problems for one of the other grad students. A week later, the chairman of the astronomy department called him over and said, "So, you're the Unix guru." At the time, Randy was still stupid enough to be flattered by this attention, when he should have recognized them as bone-chilling words. 3 years later, he left the astronomy department without a degree, and with nothing to show for his labors except $600 in his bank account and a staggeringly comprehensive knowledge of Unix. Later, he was to calculate that, at the going rates for programmers, the department had extracted about $250,000 worth of work from him, in return for an outlay of less than $20,000. The only compensation was that his knowledge didn't seem so useless anymore. Astronomy had become a highly networked discipline, and you could now control a telescope on another continent, or in orbit, by typing commands into your keyboard, watching the images it produced on your monitor. Randy was now superbly knowledgeable when it came to networks. Years ago, this would have been of limited usefulness. But this was the age of networked applications, the dawn of the World Wide Web, and the timing couldn't have been better. In the meantime, Avi had moved to San Francisco and started a new company that was going to take role-playing games out of the nerd ghetto and make them mainstream. Randy signed on as the head technologist. He tried to recruit Chester, but he'd already taken a job with a software company back up in Seattle. So they brought in a guy who had worked for a few video game companies, and later they brought in some other guys to do hardware and communications, and they raised enough seed money to build a playable prototype. Using that as their dog and pony show, they went down to Hollywood and found someone to back them to the tune of $10 million. They rented out some industrial space in Gilroy, filled it full of graphics workstations, hired a lot of sharp programmers and a few artists, and went to work.